You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this early spring 2009 podcast, we're looking at recent world and art house cinema releases on DVD and in cinemas. To this end, comedian Jessica Fostercue and myself are talking to the creators of a couple of highly anticipated new world cinema films that received rapturous attention at Cannes, Moscow, Belgium, and Il Divo. Later, I'll be reviewing the new Spanish sci-fi thriller Time Crimes, and our new writer David Warwick will be looking at the DVD of the classic British silent film The Battle of the Somme. First, here's my interview with the director Christophe Van Rompuy and star Jürgen Delnet of the new Belgian rom-com Moscow, Belgium, which tells the tale of the bittersweet romance between harassed mother of three, Matty, and rakish lorry driver, Johnny. To give you a taste of the film, here's an extract from the trailer.
Neoclassics Films proudly presents the New York Times Critics' Pick.
Sorry, my clute, madame.
Alles rond uw camion is een dooinoek. In feite zijn ik blind.
Winner, Critics' Week Cannes 2008.
Hallo.
De Johnny zit.
Kom
je neer? Je niet te zoeken! Nathalie. Bonjour. Ja, pak dan mee, madame. Hij is gedronken.
Passionate and impulsive, the movie's steady attention to detail lends it a texture rarely found in films.
Lima is
like
10 jaar jonger.
Ik heb het gevoel.
A triumph of remarkable luck and talent. Barbara Serafian gives an Oscar-caliber performance. Moscow, Belgium.
Hi, Alex. This is Christoph.
Hi, this is Jürgen.
Okay, ready when you are.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I watched the film a couple of nights ago, and I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. Good start.
I didn't know that Belgium had a history of romantic comedies, because we only get select examples over here, things like Man Bites Dog, the work of the Dardenne brothers. I mean, what sort of...
Not exactly romantic comedies, you're
mentioning. Well, exactly. So, yeah. So what sort of tradition does the romantic comedy have in Belgium?
The company we made this film with actually made a few classical romantic comedies. Because, actually, for this film, they're using it more as a marketing tool, because I don't consider it to be a romantic comedy.
Okay.
More like a... romantic tragedy or a dramatic comedy or something, because it's about sort of serious subject, but not treated in a serious way. But we have in Belgium there are a few like you have the Bridget Jones Diary things.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff being made like that as well, but it doesn't cross over because it's with the Belgian or Flemish stars in it, and it's not necessarily a good film, but people go and see it in masses because there's famous people in it.
Mm. And presumably also there's a lot of Belgian humour that's reliant on local knowledge, and so it doesn't necessarily have a more international appeal.
Exactly. There's things in the script that are typically Flemish or something, or the only Flemish people would know. They're not universal stories. Yeah.
I suppose this is a question for Jürgen. When it came to playing a bit of a rogue who's also quite a lovable lead, what sort of experience did you draw on for that?
My own life experience. No. I did do some casting work before getting enrolled in this picture.
Mm.
So apparently I was the right person for this character. So it has to do with looks, of course, and with the way you talk and the way I don't know, you fill in the character. But experience, since this is my first feature film experience, I didn't really have an experience in playing that type of character. I was immediately charmed by the story when I read the script for the first time. That was why I really wanted to do the casting and hope for the best. So this is where we are now.
Okay.
And he blew us away.
So there was no method acting involved. You didn't travel to Italy to buy romantic gifts at any point?
Not that particular example, but I did how to drive a truck, so that was quite method acting, yes.
I mean, I don't know what it's like in Belgium, but certainly in Britain, truck drivers don't exactly get portrayed on screen very often.
In Belgium, neither. The profession of truck driver is not glamorous at all. It's it's a very difficult profession, and truck drivers are not regarded as heroes or something. People always nag about truck drivers whenever there's trouble on the road or on the highways. It's always there's always some truck driver involved and things like that. So it was quite a risky trade to get that profession in the film.
It's also a challenge because like in those traditional comedies you talk about, or well, and any more in a lot of films, professions or people are often characterized as sort of the cliche. He's a truck driver, so he is like that. Instead of, there could be a person inside there who just happens to be a truck driver, but could be a very interesting character and have another life besides being in a truck or something. And the interesting thing is with making this film, that you're confronted with the fact that people are not like black or white, and they're just more complex, and fighting those cliches was an interesting thing.
Well, I thought all the characters in it were very three-dimensional. I mean, obviously Johnny has his romantic past that is still affecting him, from the tattoo to, you know, sort of bumping into his ex in the street, his struggles with alcoholism, and then his attempts to actually, you know, to be a charming man, to be involved with this woman, and even a possible friend to their children. And then someone like Matty, I mean, she's not a traditional romantic lead. I mean, certainly in Hollywood and in Britain, you get the impression that women past a certain age don't get enough movie roles anymore because they're not glamorous enough. But I thought she was a very interesting character and, you know, very engaging.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. It's a beautiful part, a real woman's part, and not the 20-year-old beautiful girl part. What was the question, actually?
Well, I suppose just when it came to crafting these three-dimensional characters, I suppose it's as much a collaboration between the director and the actor as it is reading into the script what sort of nuances are present on this page.
Maybe I want to say that, one of the challenges, in fact, was that this is indeed not really a glamorous story. It's more like a real-life story in this regard, that it depicts life as it is. And sometimes, for the viewer, for the audience, this can be very comforting as well. I believe that an artificial product, and by this I mean a work of art, doesn't always have to be glamorous or completely fictional. I think it can be very comforting and very, very recognizable, very interesting, and very usable for your own life to see things as they are in a work of art.
That's interesting, because when I think about what kind of film I really like, it can be very, really broad. It can be a science fiction story, it can be a comedy, but it somehow always touched you in a certain way that you make a reflection towards your own life. And as you said, like towards being not a very common character for a romantic comedy, it's like I said in the beginning, it's we weren't really thinking, oh, we're making a romantic comedy. We were not playing the jokes or something. When there's a funny line in the script, you try to find how that character comes to say a line like that and make it as real as possible, and then it's suddenly funny. But if you play it funny, it's not funny. So it's actually the funny lines were actually the more difficult things to do on the set. Am I making sense?
Yes, no, definitely. I mean, I suppose an American movie of recent times that it reminded me of was The Good Girl by Mike White, which is all about a shop worker who sort of wants to be a better person than she is. But of course, in Hollywood, she inevitably gets played by Jennifer Aniston. Well, well, at least in Europe, because you're looking perhaps more for interesting people rather than famous actors, there's going to be more honesty when making a movie of that type.
Yeah, well, there there was some, I have to be honest with you, that in the beginning, during the pre-production and the casting phase, they confronted me with the fact, like, look, what are you doing? It's like, you've been trying to make a film for such a long time. It's your first feature film. You're an unknown director. Mm. You're choosing all these unknown actors. Well, at that time they were. And you make them speak in a dialect that almost nobody understands. So this is not going to be a box office hit. And we were very lucky that it was a small budget thing, because otherwise there would have been more involvement and more pressure from above, as they say, to have somebody known in there or something. Luckily, one of the producer, the main producer, was also one of the script writers, so he was, besides controlling the budget, he was also very interested in making a good film, because it's also his baby as a writer, and so he was behind us every step of the way. So that was good.
In Belgium, cinema is Moscow a place that's been captured on film before? Because obviously, for British viewers, we probably don't know much about Belgian geography in general, let alone, you know, the suburbs of Ghent.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as you know, Belgium is divided in two parts: the French-speaking part and the Flemish. We have both. We have two governments, two film funds, and we consequently have to co-produce with our own country if we want to work together and raise a certain amount of money. And the city we all come from and the dialect that's spoken in the film is Ghent. Mm. And Moscow is a little place on the outskirts of Ghent in a suburb. And it's called like that because of, during the war against the French Emperor Napoleon, the Russian soldiers were stationed there. Some Cossacks had a caserne there, and that's the reason why it's called like that.
Okay. I thought aesthetically the film was really interesting. For a place that's obviously a bit downhill, you actually made it quite charming.
But it's an arena, and it was a sort of obvious choice, because... for example, if we would have set it here in Bristol or something... Then I would have to come over here, work with actors that speak the typical accent. I had to know about customs and language. But since the story is universal, it can be everywhere. But it's logical for us to do it in something we know, in an environment and with people we're comfortable with. And so it's easier to spot when something's off in the scene, and it's like, no, that won't happen like that, or it's not it's not right. And if you're in a strange place, it's more difficult to, you need a lot more preparation or work. I had to come here for 3 months or something and live in that place to be able to have the same feel about it that I have with the city of Ghent. And Ghent has been used in films quite often, but more the, how do you say that, more the beautiful spots, the medieval towers and the beautiful cathedrals and stuff like that, and the great marketplace, but never the outskirts of the city.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I suppose it's the equivalent of Americans making films in London and just showing the same tourist areas over and over again.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
When it came to getting a feel for the characters, I suppose shooting in certain locations kind of helped you inhabit the role a lot more. I mean, I'm thinking of the romantic scene between Matty and Johnny in the truck, and then the karaoke scene later on.
Yeah, that helps, of course. But that's the how'd you say, that's part of, for me at least, that's the magic of film. You put all these things, all these different aspects together. I mean, I studied my lines, I prepared myself, I dug into the text, but then there's also the director with his view, with his angle. There's the art department. There's the costume designer, and all these things. I mean, part of my character is also the way I look, and that's decided by somebody else. And there's also the music that adds up to all those things. So it's not really only, it's not only my personal job.
And as far as the locations go, it's true. Somehow it's hard to shoot on location. There's much more possibilities of things going wrong than when you're in a controlled environment like a studio. But somehow it turned into an advantage as well, because every location has its limits, which are there, like in real life, and if you adapt to that, it sort of adds to the realism, and for this film and for this particular story, it was the exact right thing we needed.
Mm. Well, I suppose, Christoph, you've worked as a producer, a production manager on both film and TV. When it came to directing your first feature, did having a variety of roles in other productions make it a lot easier to sort of step behind the camera?
Oh, absolutely. It was not my first feature as director, but like you said, I was lucky. I think I almost did every job on a set, and the longest thing was being an assistant director. But in a way, it's especially when you have only 20 days. As you've done the work the other people are doing, you also know what their problems are, and so you can immediately spot if something's wrong or somebody has a problem. You know why they have the problem, and that actually helps in avoiding stress and frustration. And they feel comfortable because you know what they're doing in a way as well, which creates some sort of trust. I think I don't know exactly how to formulate it, but it's a cliche, but doing this in this certain way, we were like this one big family because it was a small crew, and we were very mobile, and everybody was like working on the same film, and that's important because I've been on a lot of sets where people actually were working on different films, it's good that you're all on the same track somehow. Mm. It helps if you know what they're doing, yeah.
I suppose as a producer, you're a little bit more hands-off. You don't have to be the captain of the ship like you might have to be as a director. In terms of your other work, there's a couple of films that you worked on as producer, Alias and the short Gridlock. Mm-hmm. Finding a wider audience for those projects, did being a little bit more dispassionate help? Or now that you've been a director, do you realise kind of the amount of stress that the director has to go to?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's we come from a little place where the word industry is actually a joke.
Okay.
We don't have a film industry. So people who work in this area just must do different things just to be able first to get by, and because they're passionate about something. And even with this project, I was not the producer, but I'm not blind and deaf for the problems of a producer because I've been in that situation, and vice versa. When I'm a director, when I'm a producer, I directing has always been my first ambition, but because you can't do it full time where I come from, you just need to do other things as well. And again, it only helps in the communication and knowing what people's jobs are and what problems they're facing. It gives you some sort of respect of for the people you work with in a way. So, but they're so different because I really like some aspects of producing, finding the right people, bringing them together. But there are also so many frustrating aspects, and they tend to clash with the director job as well. So I will never do that again. At the same, being the producer and the director on a project is just, these two hats you're wearing are just too different. Mm. It's a full job. You shouldn't do them together, I think.
You said that the actors on the film were fairly unknown. Since the film came out, it's now won various awards. It was very well received at Cannes. Have both of you been receiving all sorts of offers since it came out?
The fact is that now in Belgium, I'm also known in the so-called film industry.
Okay.
Because I'm mainly a stage actor still. And that's the strange thing. Even in a small community like Flanders, there's sometimes a real wall between the stage world and the film world.
Mm-hmm.
So now the film people know me as well. So that's a good thing. And yes, I have received some offers, some interesting, some not. and I have the luxury. I have to add this. I have the luxury of choice because I have quite some work in the theatre, so I can choose. I can choose the interesting things I really want to do. Yes.
I didn't get a call from Harvey Weinstein yet. It's actually a very strange situation because I've been traveling quite a bit doing promo for this film, and as a result, people have the impression that I'm really busy. So I'm actually not getting any phone calls at the moment, which is a strange coincidence of things coming together, I think, and perception of people. We were supposed to shoot another film this winter, which didn't happen because of financing, I'm working on a project which is in a very stage of the very beginning. Actually, it's a treatment phase with the same writers as Moscow, Belgium, but nothing concrete at the moment. No.
Okay. Well, look forward to new projects from both of you.
Thank you very much.
Moscow, Belgium comes out on DVD in the UK on May the 25th. Paolo Sorrentino has built up a well-deserved reputation as one of Italy's finest new directors in recent years, with the excellent thrillers The Consequences of Love and The Family Friend. His new film Il Divo, which is in cinemas now, is a biopic of Italy's notorious three times former Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti, whose career was perennially tainted with alleged associations with the mafia and mafia-related murders. Andreotti was investigated for his role in the 1979 murder of a journalist who had published allegations that Andreotti had ties to the mafia, and to the kidnapping of Prime Minister Aldo Moro. A court acquitted him in 1999 after a case that lasted 3 years, but he was convicted on appeal in November 2002 and sentenced to life imprisonment. In October the 30th next year, though, an appeals court overturned the conviction and acquitted Andreotti of the original murder charge. The same year, the court of Palermo acquitted him of ties to the mafia, but only on grounds of expiration of statutory terms. Sorrentino's film is a great mafia thriller that reunites him with the star of The Consequences of Love, and one that bears comparison to Francis Ford Coppola's Godfather trilogy. Comedian and actress Jessica Fostercue caught up with the director by phone while he was at a press junket in Dublin and asked him about making the film.
Your films tend to follow a male leading character in a very intimate way. Is this why you chose Andreotti, or did you have a personal interest in his history and the controversy?
I chose Andreotti because it's a kind of man with a very complex psychological characteristics, and so I thought it was a good subject for the cinema. And at the same time, I was very interested at the political and the social context of the Italy in the 90s. This context was rarely explored by the Italian cinema, and in this context, Andreotti covers an important role by protagonist, and so I thought that there were all good elements for doing a film.
You also wrote the screenplay. Was this entirely based on recorded events, or did you have to extrapolate some of the dialogue from the kind of things he said to the people who knew him?
It's a mix. Usually some lines, some things tied to the humor are of Andreotti, and other scenes comes from private information that I found while I have. While I frequented the friends or people that knew him, and at some time, principally in the things about private life of Andreotti, I invented because it was not simple for me to find private information about his life.
One line in particular seems to sum up his contempt for ordinary people's lives. A tree needs manure in order to grow. Was that something he actually said, or was it paraphrasing his sorts of aphorisms?
Those are words of
In Il Divo, you've collaborated again with Tony Servillo, who gives another subtle and brilliant performance. How much of his characterisation of Andreotti is based on the man's actual mannerisms, and how much of it came from Tony's interpretation of that kind of character?
We chose few characteristics of Andreotti, and we decided to follow those characteristics, but at the same time we decided to invent an our Andreotti. It was not so important for me to use Servillo like a sosie of Andreotti.
One of the keys to Andreotti's character, at least through his portrayal by Tony, is how his thought process is possibly revealed through his hand gestures, his tells, to use a poker term. Did you decide that this was one of the keys to revealing his nature on film, or was that something true to life?
No, I think the episode about hands is more a joke than other. In true, all the life of Andreotti is in the mind, in the head, and for this reason he suffers of a headache, because he has everything in the mind, and I suppose that he has nothing in the heart.
It's been a year since Il Divo won the Grand Jury Prize at Cannes. Do you find it frustrating that it takes so long for films to get released after completion?
It's not frustrating. It's normal that a film lives for 1 or 2 years, and for me it's normal. The other films that I do, it was the same, and it's not a problem for me, no.
Il Divo is in cinemas now. To coincide with the 90th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme, the Imperial War Museum commissioned a restoration and new score for the 1916 silent movie, which is now available on DVD. Here's what our reviewer David Warwick had to say about the film.
Recently restored and released on DVD by the Imperial War Museum, The Battle of the Somme is a 74-minute documentary depicting the lead-up to and first few days of the defining Battle of World War I. Filmed in June and July 1916 by military cameramen Geoffrey H. Malins and J.B. McDowell, and swiftly edited also by Malins and by Charles Urban, the film was released in Britain on the same year, on the 10th of August, while the offensive continued in France. In the first 6 weeks of the film's release, an estimated 20 million people went to see it at cinemas around Britain, making it one of the most successful films of all time. In 2005, UNESCO, the United Nations Educational and Scientific Cultural Organization, inscribed the Battle of the Somme into its Memory of the World Register, confirming its importance both as a historical document and as a requiem for the hundreds of thousands of men killed in the offensive. Widely accepted as a propaganda film, there is no denying that the Battle of the Somme one-sidedly glorifies and cheers on the British troops, chiefly through title boards that separate the film into 5 parts and intercut the action to explain what is happening. The text on these boards includes such hyperbole as "terrific bombardment of German trenches" and "a glorious and successful charge" and "nerve-shattered German soldiers arriving." Despite this, however, the film is never guilty of trying to incite hatred for the German army. Quite the opposite, in fact. It is frequently full of sympathy and respect for the German loss of life. And so it is questionable whether it is the film's patriotic bias that is really the thing to concentrate on. Undoubtedly for modern audiences it won't be, with their critical distance from the subject matter and ingrained awareness of the manipulative techniques of moving images, modern audiences will quickly recognise the film's propagandist appeals and dismiss them as silly. In light of this, I would suggest that the film is most striking now, not as a piece of propaganda, but as a montage of images which are more anti-war than pro, and which have an almost metaphysical resonance in their depiction of abundant life and abundant death. The 2009 DVD version of The Battle of the Somme comes with the options of 2 different musical scores, a new orchestral score composed by Laura Rossi, and a medley of music that was originally recommended as an accompaniment to the film in 1916. Thinking through the pros and cons of each score raises questions about how audiences experienced the film in 1916, and about what would constitute an authentic 1916 experience of the film today. Rossi's score is more brooding and serious and reflective of the overall human suffering. The music medley, on the other hand, is cheerier and seems to assist the propagandist agenda of the film. Rossi's score will be more palatable to modern tastes, but is guilty of breathing new meaning into the images, which may or may not be wanted. For those looking for authenticity, the music medley would seem like the best option, but is equally problematic. Though the medley is indeed closer to the music that would have been heard in 1916, hearing it in 2009, filtered through modern tastes and expectations, is necessarily a very different experience. There is no getting around these authenticity dilemmas, and actually my preference would always be to watch the Battle of the Somme in silence, such as the power of its images. The impact of the Battle of the Somme doesn't come from seeing hordes of soldiers climbing out of trenches and running at machine gun fire as one might perhaps expect. We actually see very little combat, and what we do see in the infamous over-the-top scene is staged anyway and quite forgettable. The Battle of the Somme is much more a depiction of the sprawling human activity that took place behind the trench line. We see men marching, men queuing for dinner, men receiving letters from home, men at a makeshift church service on the eve of battle, and men operating giant pieces of artillery. Sometimes the men crowd into the camera's view and smile and wave with a childlike innocence. Other times they are completely engrossed in their physical work and the camera goes unnoticed. Again, though, we never see any actual violence between the two armies. The violence is always out of view, imminent, or recently passed. This is particularly apparent in the five-day artillery bombardment of the German trenches that is the main focus of the second part of the film. Here, British soldiers load enormous shells into enormous cannons before ducking out of the way as they fire into the air. Save for a few distant explosions on the battlefield, the immediate devastation caused by these shells is never shown, and it is all the more sinister because of it. We can only wonder as to whether these shells found their targets, and as to the terror that must have gripped the German trenches throughout this bombardment. For modern audiences, the Battle of the Somme should be a reminder of the moral power of film, of the celluloid strip. We're quite accustomed to seeing people and places ravaged by war on the news on television, but only via the cheap, expendable medium of video, wholly inadequate at capturing the textures, tones, and movement of the real. By contrast, the Battle of the Somme calls on all the mystical qualities of 35mm film and offers images which are painfully vivid and which appeal directly to the heart. Shots are long and inquisitive and capture the surrounding detail as much as the human activity. Dead animals, the dark of a bunker, wind blowing through trees and grass, widespread mud, rubble and ruined buildings. The sight of this multitudinous detail alongside the human multitude issues in the viewer that awestruck, humbled feeling that is the mark of the best cinema. These images remind us that we are part of something greater and serve to stoke our outrage at the Somme offensive for all its divisive, destructive crimes against humanity and nature. At the end of part three, in a sequence of precise, carefully photographed shots, the camera rests on the dead. Damp German bodies packed together as a single mass in the mud, anonymous men lying alone on the battlefield, a German commander fallen with his dog, a hunched, lifeless soldier sat in the corner of a trench. This sequence is really the core of the Battle of the Somme, and the point at which its contemplative, philosophical quality is most apparent. As observed, all throughout the film, the abundant life of the British war effort is pictured alongside abundant violence and death, always just out of view. Here, however, death is very much in view. It is the whole view. With the same intensity that it previously stared at marching men and myriad mud and rubble, here the camera stares at lifeless corpses, one after another. There is no politics in the arrangements of light and dark that form the lifeless images, only the mystery of death that hangs over all human beings and which has been revealed to these men much before their time. The prolonged and emphatic focus forces the viewer to reflect not just on the atrocious death toll of the Somme offensive, but also on human mortality more generally. It is rare in Western culture to sit and contemplate death, though a curious feature, for example, of Buddhist meditation. In the final analysis, the Battle of the Somme is revealed less as a piece of propaganda and more as a thoughtful, poetic work of cinema, which, through mourning the dead, seeks meaning in the flux of life.
The DVD of The Battle of the Somme is available now from all good film shops and from the online shop at iwm.org.uk. If you'd like to know more about the restoration and history of the film of The Battle of the Somme, you can download my interview with the Imperial War Museum film programmer Toby Haggith and National Army Museum historian Andrew Robertshaw, which was transmitted on Resonance FM in December 2006 and is now available as a podcast, which you'll find the link for on our blog, www.electricsheepmagazine.wordpress.com. Available on DVD in the first week of May 2009 is the Spanish science fiction thriller Time Crimes. The doppelganger is a surprisingly underused idea in horror and science fiction cinema. There's a risible Roger Moore movie called The Man Who Haunted Himself, the many Michael J. Foxes in Back to the Future Parts 2 and 3, the comedy personification of Clark Kent's schizophrenia in Superman 3, and a handful of scenes in Terminator 2 Judgment Day, where the T-1000 impersonates various characters. However, recent films have more seriously explored the idea, for example Sean Ellis's The Broken, Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Doppelganger, which revolves around the legend that meeting one's double is a presager of death, and now Nacho Vigalondo's 2007 film Time Crimes. In Time Crimes, Vigalondo carefully mixes tropes of serial killer films with the methodical, cerebral plotting of a time travel story. Hector is a middle-class everyman and occasional voyeur who finds himself attacked by a bandaged bogeyman when he goes into the woods to investigate what happened to the woman that he'd been peeping at. Running away from this frightening figure, he stumbles across an advanced physics lab and hides in what turns out to be a time machine, escaping into the past. A low budget is often the downfall of many slasher movies, but by limiting his cast to 5 actors, the sets to a handful of evocative locations, and using occasionally impenetrable cinematography that recalls David Fincher's Seven, Vigalondo has made a terrific thriller that provides a modern riposte to Hitchcock's Rear Window. Appropriately, the director himself appears in the film as the Deus Ex Machina, a lab attendant who is experimenting with his superior's time machine. He later revisits Christopher Lloyd's famous scene in Back to the Future Part 2, drawing a diagram to explain the mechanics of time travel to both the unwitting participant and the audience. Here, as in American time travel movie Primer, the audience may be left scratching their heads. In both films, parts of the plot don't quite make sense. But that said, as Hector goes back in time yet again, the audience is so completely hooked that minor inconsistencies do not matter anymore. In any case, the film is likely to provide spirited conversations among the audience after the credits have rolled. Time Crimes is apparently set to be remade in English by David Cronenberg later this year, and he seems the ideal director for the task. Time Crimes is almost a thematic sequel to his film The Fly, where another precocious individual's existence is disturbed by going from one magic box to another. As Time Crimes is all about revisiting the past, it suits the film to be aware of its predecessors. As well as the influences mentioned above, there are visible elements from Dario Argento's The Bird with the Crystal Plumage and Doctor Who, in particular the episodes in which the Doctor meets a ghostly fetch and then gets caught in a trans-temporal maze inspired by M.C. Escher. As all film is a kind of time travel for the audience, the creator of this particular device has proved himself an impressive tour guide, and I certainly look forward to another trip under his control. Time Crimes is released on DVD in the UK on May the 4th by Optimum Home Entertainment. You can read a transcript of my review of Time Crimes in the latest issue of Electric Sheep magazine, which is available from a variety of stockists and from the publishers Wallflower Press with a 15% discount. Info about which you can find at www.electricsheepmagazine.com. I'd like to thank Jessica Fostercue and David Warwick for their contributions to this podcast, and there'll be a new episode of the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast online soon. Thanks for listening.